For now, we're going to look at John's Gospel and have a short reading from that. So if you'd like to pick up the Gospel booklets that you've got on your chair. It's John chapter 11. In this white booklet, it's on page 32. I'm not sure about the blue booklet. Somebody could find that. John chapter 11. What page is it, Anna? Also 32. Brilliant. So page 32. And we're going to be reading from verse 1, that's the little number 1, to 6. Little number 6, and then picking up at 17 and reading through to 45. Right, here we go. Oh, I should probably say as well, these John's Gospels, the little booklets, you can take those away with you. So if you want to make notes or scribble down any questions that you have in here, do feel free to do that. They're yours to take away at the end. Right, here we go. Now a certain man was ill. Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, that is Jesus, saying, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." But when Jesus heard it, he said, "This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Now, we're going to skip verses 7 to 16. In that time, Jesus, after staying for 2 days where he is, then heads off to go to be where Lazarus is and takes his disciples with him. So picking it up at the little number 17. Now, when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Lazarus had died. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everybody who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you're the Christ, the Son of God, who's coming into the world." When she said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here, and he's calling for you." And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, By this time there will be an odour, for he's been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. When he'd said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. Many of the Jews, therefore, who'd come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Well, Kev, the minister of Euston Church, is now going to come up and give you a short talk for 20 minutes. Again, do remember to jot your questions down as we go. Over to you, Kev.
Great, thanks, Rob, and thanks to all of you for coming. It's very nice to meet you, and really grateful that you've been willing to take the time out for this evening to come and think about this important subject. If you watched any of the UK news channels last night, you probably saw the heart-rending story of William Meade, a cute little one-year-old boy who died after the medics repeatedly missed the fact that a chest infection was actually something much more serious. The health secretary was apologising yesterday for the failings of the system, and William's mum was on the news bulletins interviewed. She had this teddy. They keep William's ashes inside one of his teddies, and she was talking about how just her family had been ripped apart by the loss of their perfect little son. As the father of a one-year-old, when I saw that news bulletin come round the next hour, I could barely watch it again. So grim what had happened to them. You might know that just a few streets over in that direction over there is Great Ormond Street Hospital, one of the specialist hospitals for children in the whole world, actually. And you wouldn't need to walk into that hospital. You just need to walk past on the street, as I did earlier today. And you'll see little kiddies in wheelchairs, tubes coming out of them, some just looking just terribly, terribly ill. If you walk out of this building just in that direction, you'll straight away hit Tavistock Square. That's where the bus bomb exploded in the 2005 July London bombings. I knew one of the guys who died on the bus. Jamie was my age. He was just engaged newly, and he was excited about all that life held ahead until he made the mistake of going to the upper deck and sitting on the seat directly in front of the suicide bomber. And we could talk about Paris, we could talk about Syria, but even here in the middle of our young, healthy city, things scream at us that this is a broken world. And I want to say at the start, I've not been asked to do this talk because I'm kind of some sort of expert sufferer or anything like that. I live in this broken world, as all of us do. But I'm very conscious that some of you will have had experience of the pain this world brings our way that might be much more intense and much more raw maybe right now than anything that I've ever experienced. These are hard questions in every sense, and the aim tonight, just so you're clear, is definitely not to try and give neat answers that will take the pain away. It wouldn't be possible, but the Bible does have helpful things to say. That reading was from John's Gospel, as Rob told us. John's one of the eyewitness accounts of the life of Jesus that we have in the Bible, and I'm going to make a couple of assumptions as we go through this, that I'd love you to come back and question me on in the question time at the end, if you would like to. The first is that this is historically reliable. And the last time we did one of these Wednesday lectures a few months ago, we had a Cambry boffin who's a Christian, come and speak to us about the historical reliability of the New Testament, you could get hold of that talk from our website. Or as I say, ask me questions about that aspect at the end. The second assumption that I'm going to make is basically John's big starting assumption, which is that Jesus Christ is God. And I'm aware that is an extraordinary assumption and claim. But what that means is that if John is right, if he can start to show us Jesus speaking and responding on the suffering question, then that's the beginnings for us of starting to see God speaking and responding in the face of human suffering. John 11 is actually about the day that Jesus was asked the why question. We always ask why, don't we? Suffering happens 3 times in these verses. So Lazarus dies, and his sister Martha says to Jesus in sentence 21, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died." Implication, why weren't you? Mary, the other sister, meets him in sentence 32. "Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died.'" And maybe that's just an outflowing of remorse with Mary and Martha, but there's certainly a real accusation by the time we get to sentence 37. The crowd, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" Jesus could have stopped this, couldn't he? So why didn't he? Why doesn't God end all the suffering if he is so powerful and so good? I want to say 3 quick things on this before we go to our question time. There's some points on the sheet there, and we'll rattle through them very quickly, but if it's helpful for you to follow along. The first one is to say that God cares about our suffering. And I think we can see that here really easily from the way Jesus is with this family. So they're close friends of his. It keeps going on about how he loved them. And when Jesus does finally arrive at the scene, his job is certainly not to be the stiff upper lip in the room. Sentence 33, "When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled." Sentence 35, "On his way to the graveyard, Jesus wept." And again, when he arrives at the tomb, sentence 38, "Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb." Now, this is actually a very English translation, this phrase, "deeply moved." I mean, can you imagine turning up at someone's funeral and saying, "I am deeply moved that you are dead"? You'd have to be the most British person in the world to say it. Actually, this is a phrase that's to do with being angry. And apparently it was used with horses, you know, the way they snore out the fumes from their nostrils. That's the picture of Jesus here. Red-faced, maybe the snot running down his beard as he cried. I grew up going to Sunday school. We used to sing a song that had actions, as they all did at Sunday school. It was called "With Christ in the Vessel, You Can Smile at the Storm." And it basically went, "With Christ in the vessel, you can smile in the storm, smile at the storm, smile at the storm. With Christ in the vessel, you can smile at the storm as we go sailing home." And then this is the best bit, when you go, "Sailing, sailing home," and you chevied into the person next to you, and it all descended into a riot as you sail home. Now, that was great fun, great cheesy song. Terrible theology in that song. See, having Jesus with you in the storm really changes things. But not in the sense of we just merrily go on our way smiling indifferently in the face of tragedy. And I'm afraid that sometimes Christianity has either been presented as if that's what it is saying, or it's just been heard and given the impression that that's what it's saying. It's not true. Look at Jesus here. He knows that he is about to make things all right in the most wonderful way. And yet his first response in the face of grief, Jesus doesn't smile in the storm. He blubs like a baby. And there's the first part of our answer. When God comes to his world and confronts broken bodies and broken hearts and sees refugee infants washed up on beaches, he is crying with us. He shares our sense that this isn't the way the world is supposed to be. And actually, you know, it's the fact that God cares that really creates our question, because if we could say God doesn't care, there would be a really easy answer. And he doesn't end the suffering because ultimately he's not bothered. That'd be quite ruthless. It'd be quite cynical, though, quite clear to understand. But if he cares, then it gets messy. Why, if he cares, does he allow all this suffering and evil to go on? And this is our second point, that God is not powerless in the face of human tragedy. See, sometimes people so emphasize that first point, God cares, that it leads them to conclude that God must be powerless in the face of a world gone wrong. Must be like his hands are somehow tied on this, because if he does exist and he does care, surely if he was powerful enough, he would always intervene to end the pain. That isn't actually the Bible picture. It's not the picture of this story. See, Jesus certainly wasn't powerless here. He could have cured Lazarus easily and straight away. A couple of pages back, he cured lifelong blindness. But spot the surprising thing he does or doesn't do here. Sentence 5. Sentence 5 says, "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was." Did you hear that? Jesus waits deliberately and lets Lazarus die. Christians need to be honest about our God and what we believe about him. We mustn't try to get him off the hook by saying his hands are tied. He's trapped in the journey of pain with us. Nothing that he can ultimately do. God is always in control. He could intervene at any moment to end any suffering, just as Jesus could here. And yet sometimes God seems to wait deliberately and chooses not to. Now please don't mishear this. This is not to say that God directly causes suffering. We could have a whole talk on the causes of suffering. Ask me about it at the end. The Bible picture is very clear that the finger of blame points at us collectively when it comes to why evil and pain are in the world. I once got chatting to one of those charity collectors at Russell Square. You know the ones you try and avoid? I sort of went with the sort of try to sort of psych them out by going the opposite way. I approached her and initiated conversation with a charity person. I asked her actually how she made sense of the idea of a God given the horrendous abuse of children that her charity were helping us all to hear about. And she thought about it for a minute and said, well, it's not God causing the problems there, it's human beings. That's not a comfortable answer, is it? But basically true. The world isn't the way it's supposed to be because we are not the way we are supposed to be. Jesus didn't kill Lazarus. He's not responsible for his death in that way. But we do need to face the fact that for some reason, he didn't stop this death either. And in this case, we get told the reason. Sentence 14. Then Jesus told them plainly, "Lazarus has died, and for your sake I'm glad that I was not there, so that you may believe." That's quite a thing to say. I'm glad I wasn't there. He's not glad about the suffering. He's glad that the end result of all of this will be more people believing who he says he is. And I'm conscious that could just sound very callous, that Jesus would think that that end result would make this family's suffering, even temporary as it was, worth it. But it is what happens. So by sentence 45, many more people believe in Jesus. And he's glad of the chance to have shown them a proof of who he is. Now, this is where we need to be very careful. See, we don't usually get told God's exact reasons for not intervening to end the suffering in the way that we get told here. But the Bible does tell us to expect that good will come out of painful situations in all kinds of ways. Many sufferers testify to that experience. Anya already has this evening. And I've put some quotes on the sheet there. If you were at church on Sunday, you might recognise these. These are basically quotes from church family people. I'm just going to read the first one. Testifying to meaning coming out of their suffering. "Harder times have forced me to consider whether the things God has said about himself are true. I can wholeheartedly thank him for those times because of how they have helped me, encouraged me, and even forced me to cling to him and all I know about him." Amazing that people are able to see in their pain some kind of purpose. But we need to be so careful, as I've already said, because even though God may have a good purpose in allowing some horrible set of events to carry on, we often, usually, won't see or understand the bigger picture of why all of that could actually have a good end result. We live in the middle of the story. And when you live in the middle of the story, it can just be very difficult sometimes to see how anything good could flow. So think about the Holocaust Memorial Day today. I mean, what preacher, what so-called guru could ever dare to stand up and say, "I'll tell you what all that meant and what the good purpose was in that"? How could we? Not smile at the storm, but can you trust a person in the storm? That's the issue. And one of the things that's helped me the most is remembering Jesus on the cross at the end of John's Gospel. See, being in control, but allowing that terrible abuse of his son to carry on, was a very painful thing for God personally. Jesus himself, he could have got down off that cross at any moment, and yet he chose not to end his own pain. For the sake of you and me, actually, and the potentially wonderful blessings that would flow in our direction as a result of his death. There's so much more to say. Do ask questions. No neat answers on this, but the cross reassures me that this is not a game, this world that we're in, as far as God is concerned. You know, the way maybe you might watch an action movie and the body count clocks up and you sit there at a distance, basically unmoved. God is involved in our suffering personally and acting in love to help our world in the most sacrificial way. I think we'll only find this any kind of comfort, though, if we get this final point, and that's the wonderful truth that God promises he will end all the suffering. That's the great message of the Bible. He loves us enough, he's in control enough, and a real day in his future diary when he will end the pain. We get a glimpse of it here from Jesus, verse 39. They all think it's crazy for Jesus to say, "Open the grave. The man's been dead for 4 days. It's going to honk really badly for one thing." But Jesus is on the warpath. So he prays. And then he shouts loudly in sentence 43, "Lazarus, come out. How much confidence would you have to do that? I mean, if it doesn't work, it's partly just a really sick joke on a grieving family. And, you know, if you were one of his advisors, you might be, you know, Jesus, don't go there, Jesus. I mean, this is going to be the end of a really fruitful ministry, you know, if this one blows. But verse 44, the man who had died came out, his hand and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. It's not exactly a sort of triumphal re-entry into the world. It's more like a three-legged race with a dishcloth over your head. But he's alive, is the important thing. Three words from Jesus change everything. And obviously this doesn't usually happen. Did you see that David Bowie's final song that came out there just before he died was called Lazarus? Very poignant, actually. Go watch it on YouTube if you haven't seen it yet, when you realise in retrospect that was his self-epitaph. No Lazarus recovery for David Bowie. Or, of course, most people. One vicar told me recently that he doesn't use this passage at funerals anymore because it never happens at those funerals, what happened to Lazarus. I think I do still want to use this passage at funerals because here is hope. And here is someone who seems to have the power to defeat death. And here from Jesus is just a taster, a one-person taster, of what he promises to do for all of his people at the end of history. It's very interesting when we think about what we mean when we say God should end all the suffering. What would that actually mean in practice if it was really going to last? It would mean changing human beings so that we don't hurt each other. God will have to change us if he's going to end the suffering. And stopping the suffering would mean finding cures for all the illnesses that defeat our bodies. It would mean reversing death itself, rewriting the DNA of the planet so that tsunamis and things don't happen. It would mean ending this world, wouldn't it, for God to end the suffering? And starting again with a different kind of people, in different kind of bodies, in a different kind of world, which is exactly Jesus' promise. Sentence 25 is the highlight of this reading. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? Do you believe this? Seems like quite an awkward question to ask someone who's in the throes of grief. But that is the big question Jesus wants to ask all of us. See, he's very realistic. He knows it's hard for people like us to believe. And that's why he's organised for this whole book full of his words and his actions that are meant to help us evaluate the evidence. Can you trust him with your brain switched on? This didn't happen in fairyland. Real history, remember? Oh, this doesn't have all the answers neatly sewn up. But my personal experience has been that Jesus makes sense of suffering and my life and our world more than anything else. Ultimately, we have to ask, where else will you go? Cut God out of the picture and the suffering questions only get harder. Atheism has nothing of comfort or hope to say. Will we blame God? Understandable, I think, that we would feel like we want to, given some of the tough things people go through. Or will we step towards him in our pain as the one person who can actually do something about our suffering and wonderfully has made promises that one day he will? Verse 25, Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, that he die, yet he shall live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? Thanks for listening.